Gen Con talking to James Wyatt like we did last year, and total gorilla podcast, as we just said, without the ook gooks. Instead, we're going to ask him real questions in English. So, how are you today?
Ook ook!
Oh, dang. Shouldn't have set him up like that.
Sorry.
So sorry.
I'm great.
Yeah. It's the best interview we've had so far.
Hit me with some of those real questions.
There's real questions in English. Okay, so the Eberron Guide just came out.
Yeah.
You worked pretty heavily on that, right?
Yeah.
Like, a lot of work.
I did a lot of work on that. I was the lead, actually, for the whole Eberron project. So the Player's Guide was under my peripheral vision while it was being worked on. But the Campaign Guide, I wrote sections of it. I heavily rewrote sections of it. One of the interesting things we did with that book is send it out to a handful of external reviewers, from Jonathan Tweet to John Rogers, who writes the TV show Leverage.
Great. And for a while I wrote the Blue Beetle comic book that was excellent.
And also Jeff Grubb and Gwendolyn Kestrel and some random player in Andy Collins' D&D game.
Lucky
a big Eberron fan. Yeah, so we actually got really useful feedback back from those people, and that resulted in a massive reworking of what is now chapter one of the book that I did. And I'm really, really glad that I did. I think it represents an advance in our campaign setting technology. It's really intended as a comprehensive how to use this book guide that lays out what the themes of the setting are and what other parts of the book reference those themes, and so how you put them all together to make your own Eberron campaign.
Did you specifically try to take some of the lessons of Forgotten Realms coming out and improve upon Eberron in that way?
Yes, absolutely.
Like, mainly in terms of just organization of how the book worked and everything.
You're talking about the Idiot's Guide to Eberron. You're talking about, like, the 10 things you need to know.
The 10 things you need to know is in the introduction, the first couple of pages of the book. But you turn the page, and then chapter one of the book is, it's called Adventuring. And it starts off with a very brief introduction to the world and the full-page world map. And then you turn that page, and you get campaign themes. And it starts off talking about the Last War and the Draconic Prophecy and urban intrigue and dungeon delving. And it's almost like an index to the stuff that's in the rest of the book. It says, if you want to run a dungeon delving campaign, here are some good antagonists. You might want to deal with the Order of the Emerald Claw going after some of the old artifacts. Here are the kinds of ruins you might be exploring, and pointing you to other parts of the book to help you pull that material together.
And some of the other themes, like the noir themes or the end of the Last War themes, that kind of stuff.
Exactly.
All the different campaign modes that you could theoretically do with the Eberron book. How about the adventure that's in there? I know you were talking about it last year, and it's the end result. It's like it's a big battle at the end with a giant doomsday machine, and there's like a skill challenge within a skill challenge. How did that all come together, and was that complicated to playtest?
It was pretty complicated to put together. I was trying with that adventure to hit on some of the highlights of the setting, including things like, we always tell people, hey, a great way to root your characters in the Last War is to start the campaign with a flashback. So I did that. I started the adventure 2 years ago. It raises people's questions like, what have my characters have been doing in the meantime? Haven't they gained any levels? And well, no, they haven't been adventuring. They've been doing other stuff. So we've got the flashback to the Day of Mourning, actually. Then fast forward to an observance of the Day of Mourning in Sharn 2 years later, a ceremony of remembrance, and bad things start happening. And there's elements of the prophecy in there that the characters discover at the beginning. And then there's a fight on a skycoach through the Towers of Sharn, like we illustrated on the cover of the 3rd edition Sharn book, and there's another version of that painting in the campaign guide as well, that I think gives you a nice sense of the depth of the city. It's looking down on the skycoach and a goblin plummeting from his little disc thing down into the...
Every adventure needs a railing kill, you know?
Yes.
What was your interaction and development of the book with the art direction of that? Because one of my favorite parts of that book is the art.
Our normal process is pretty much what happened with this book. I wrote the art order. We normally ask the lead designer of a book to pull together the art order, art descriptions for every piece of art in the book. That then goes to John Shindahedi, our senior art director for D&D, and Chris Perkins, who's the creative manager for D&D.
You just know him as the Penny Arcade podcast guy. You just send him off, and he doesn't do any work anymore.
Chris Perkins, dungeon master to the stars. So they review the art order, clarify things, expand out the descriptions that an artist needs, and then the art director for this book, specifically, it was Kate Irwin in this case, sends those art descriptions out to the artists that she thinks will do a good job with them. Then she and Chris and John all give feedback on art as it goes through, and the lead designer can be more or less involved in that process, depending on the designer's preferences, really.
How involved were you?
Fairly. This was a book that I cared a lot about, and so I kept my fingers in it as much as I could while also managing a team and being very busy. I spent a lot of time with the poster map, getting that right.
By Lee Moyer, right?
By Lee Moyer, the totally awesome freaking poster map that makes my mouth water every time I see it. I'm very, very happy with the art of that book.
So other stuff you're working on now, do you got DMG2 coming out, right?
DMG2 is coming out. I have one of the very first copies off the press back in my suitcase in my room.
What room would that be?
I'll never tell. Very happy with that book as well, although it was also a lot of work.
Is there anything that you can talk about?
Sure.
That's in there?
I think it is a book that will blow people's minds. Chapter one of the book is called Storytelling. It's written by Robin Laws. And my secret code name for that chapter, which is no longer secret as of this moment, is D&D the Indie Game. Because Robin really brought a lot of the sensibilities that you find in games that are focused around storytelling to, just as he does to his own D&D campaign. I actually got him to write that chapter because I've been reading his blog and reading about the stuff that he does in his game to involve the players in creating the story of the campaign. And I said, write that up. Put it in the DMG too. And so he did. And it's fantastic. And it will make heads explode. The people who say 4th edition is not about role-playing will no longer have a leg to stand on.
We can just, like, shove the book in their faces at this point.
Yeah.
It'll drive them away.
Let's say I have a great D&D group. You keep saying it's going to make our heads explode. Why do I need it if I have a good group? What does it expand on? You say, like, you have the indie sensibilities, but I'm just curious. It's not a criticism, but I actually mean, like, if I think everything's going fine, or I've decided to start doing skill challenges my own way, because my head's exploded already, you know? I've already exploded my brain, and now it's going to do it in a positive way. And
right. The book has a lot to offer, I think, to anyone. The first chapter, all about storytelling, it is probably not for everyone. I think there are elements of that any DM can learn from or get ideas from. But chapter two expands on encounter design, talks a lot about the story of any given encounter in your adventure, using goals besides kill all the monsters in this room as a way to make encounters more lively.
You just took one of our post ideas, literally, with that.
It talks more about adapting encounters to specific player types, the character player motivations that we talked about in DMG1. Chapter 3 is all about skill challenges. So if you've already decided to do them another way, maybe there's nothing in there for you, but if you're looking for more inspiration or ideas about how to craft them.
Yeah, how's that chapter, if she can talk about this, so, does it sort of redo the skill challenge rules with the corrections and stuff, or is it just more suggestions?
It represents the basics with the correction numbers that we published as updates. Also lays out a couple of key guiding principles and then gives a ton of examples.
Okay. So it's also, if you just want a bunch of canned skill challenges, you'll find that there too.
Yep. Chapter 4 is all about monster creation and modification. There's a cool new tool in there called Monster Themes. So if you want to do a dungeon full of Demogorgon worshippers, there's a suite of powers that you can attach to any monster to make it feel more like a Demogorgon cultist or a Demogorgon spawn thing. Yes.
I was more thinking the Demogorgon theme, you give everybody an extra head.
That is one possibility,
okay.
But not the only one. can also give everybody a pair of tentacles, for example.
Or that's a good party right there.
Chapter 5 is about adventures and campaigns, with a focus on Paragon tier adventuring. And then Chapter 6 presents the city of Sigil as a Paragon tier home base for characters, the way that we presented the Nentir Vale in DMG1.
It's a bit more expanded than what was in Manual of the Plains.
Yes.
And all that. Is it going to have more like Sigil NPCs that we might recognize?
Yes.
Or fans of the old one?
And a little adventure as well.
A little adventure set in Planescape.
Yeah.
Today at the seminar, we also heard that DMG2 is going to focus on Paragon tier, and DMG3 will focus on Epic. Do you feel that DMG1 suitably focused on Heroic specifically?
I think so.
But I mean, like, Heroic's the sort of the baseline, yeah. And you know, everyone starts at, so it doesn't have some of the same complexities, probably, right? So.
And it might be interesting at some point to talk more about what the stakes of a Heroic stage of a campaign could and should be. Who knows? Maybe DMG4 will loop back around.
Yeah. Going along with that, this is actually a reader question that we had. What would be your take on running a game from Heroic through Epic without ever involving planar creatures or extra the added level, keeping it more real, more down to earth? I think the question was originally, is it possible in D&D to do that? Which I replied, yes, but...
Yeah. I mean, a lot of our monsters have... immortal or elemental origins, especially at higher levels, but not all of them do. Dragons, for example, don't. It has been interesting to me, actually, writing the Dungeon Craft column for D&D Insider, that when I first sketched out my campaign arc, it did not involve any planar travel at all. And I had to, like, remind myself, oh yeah, we keep saying that we expect characters to be venturing out into other planes over the course of their careers. I'd better work some of that in. But my natural inclination was to keep the campaign pretty tightly focused around Greenbrier Chasm and aberrant monster that emerged out of there. So maybe that's cheating because it is revolving around an aberrant creature which is not native to this plane, but it lives there. So I have branched out from there to introduce more ideas of traveling to the Feywild and the Shadowfell and actually not beyond that. So, yeah, I think it's possible.
And, are there new artifacts presented?
Yes. Yes, there are.
Can you say how many?
I can't remember off the top of my head.
Does one of them have 7 parts?
Yes.
Uh-huh. I want it to be like, you know, some other artifact that just happens to have 7 parts.
There's a mixture of some old favorites and some brand new stuff.
Traps?
Mm-hmm.
Any more with the trap rules or anything?
Mm-hmm.
Clever played, sir.
I've said too much already!
You'll find there's a trap waiting for you outside now.
Awesome.
Too much, yeah.
Are you going to be doing a lot of design with Dark Sun?
I have been fairly hands-off. Rich Baker led the design process for that, which is actually close to wrapping up. Rich Baker is the lead designer. Rodney Thompson is the lead developer. Robert Schwalb has done a lot of design work on it. All three of them are huge Dark Sun goobs. I did a lot of work with Bill Slavisek at the beginning to kind of chart out the parameters and give Rich some clear direction. And we've got some mechanical innovations in the setting that have required a lot of discussion with the whole department in nailing down how we want things to work exactly. So my involvement has been fairly hands-off, but aware and informed.
With Dark Sun, you sort of run into the big issue that kind of ties back to Eberron too, where you have like tieflings and dragonborn that weren't around before, really. And then how do you get them there and that kind of thing? I assume that's going to be a big challenge for Dark Sun, you think? Is that why it involves the whole department?
On the scale of things that have involved the whole department, that's actually a fairly small one, but it's there.
Okay. Are you looking forward to Dark Sun personally?
Yeah. I was never a huge Dark Sun player. One very weird little campaign in Pittsburgh years and years ago that didn't last very long. Group I met on the internet. But I always liked the setting and excited about what my team has done with it.
Are you a Psyonix fan? Or?
I am a Psyonix fan.
Yeah. Even way back in the second edition?
Yep. Yep. Even in first edition.
Even in first edition.
Do you Reverend like Arthur Cromwell? Collins presented the Psionicist class for the first time. I played one.
Oh, wow.
At a Dragon magazine. Yep.
Did you roll for Wild Towns before that?
Oh, of course.
Of course.
And I always rolled really high. It's amazing.
What is your take or opinion on the 4th edition Scion, as presented so far with what Bruce Cordell did with it mechanically and then all the fluff that's gone along with it for the PHB 3?
I think it's awesome. I think it's a very effective controller and really captures the feel of what psionics ought to be without trying to do too much all at once. You know, I don't think psionics should ever have been such a broad spectrum as arcane magic was, for example, trying to cover too many bases. It's got a very distinct flavor and feel to what sorts of effects it should be producing. And I think we nailed that for PH3.
On Twitter, you're always talking about, like, oh, I'm going to play in another game. Oh, I'm going to play in another game. How many games do you play in regularly?
Five.
Five games on a regular basis.
So I have one game every Thursday night, which I'm actually on leave of absence for until October because I'm doing a play. Mike Merles runs a lunchtime campaign Tuesdays and Thursdays every week. I run a lunchtime game Fridays. Sporadically, that's my Greenbrier campaign, but the summer in particular, people have been out a lot on Fridays. I play in a game that Andy Collins runs once a month, and a game that Jeremy Crawford runs once a month with my wife and son also in that group. So in a given month, I probably play D&D about 12 or 13 times.
It's pretty good.
It is pretty good.
It's impressive. Yeah.
I miss it when weird things happen, like Gen Con or vacations that...
It messes up your game schedule.
A week and a half goes by, and I haven't played D&D. Jonesing for it. Yeah. It's good.
So in the spirit of the contest running here, I think we're going to indulge you this once and ask you about your character or characters.
I have, in fact, tweeted about my four characters.
Okay.
So they are Jarek, who is a half-elf sorcerer. His father is the Thane of Londair. This is in Jeremy's game. But he is pretty crazy, so he did not inherit his father's position. His younger brother did, who is fully human. Adrian is my elf rogue in Andy's game. He had a strange encounter in the Witchwood that left him with a Fey Pact. So he's a rogue with warlock multiclass. Then he died, and when he was raised, Andy said, something came back with me. So I've been playing him a little creepy and sadistic since then, waiting for the rest of the group to pick up on that. Oh, we thought that was your normal self.
They may notice it now.
Yeah. Barrett is my human paladin in Bill's Thursday night game. He's a paladin of Arathis. On a lifelong quest to rebuild civilization. And Saman is my human fighter in Mike's game, lunchtime game. He's from Ket. He has had a long and distinguished military career, distinguished in the sense that he's been responsible for some number of disasters militarily. He probably should have studied wizardry harder.
Right.
He has an iron sword of elemental might that seems to be leading him toward a strange destiny.
That actually ties into Jeremy at the seminar today. I mentioned that he was running you and your son in the same game. Can you talk a little bit about the experience of playing with your son?
Oh, I love playing with my son. He is so creative. When I brought home the Dungeon Delve book in February, he saw it. He didn't want to run it. He didn't want me to run anything out of it. He wanted to design adventures just like that. So he started designing all these three-encounter adventures that he ran us through, me and my wife, and started crafting story arcs that connected them together. Hey, all right, my son is a dungeon master. But I've been playing with him since he was maybe 8. He's 12 now. And he plays regularly in this campaign. Jeremy is an awesome storyteller and works a lot of story exposition even into the middle of a combat encounter. That particularly appeals to my wife, but also my son really enjoys all the nuances of detail. So when Carter was DMing, he started picking up on things like when you kill a goblin in Jeremy's game, it melts into a puddle of goo, because the goblins are strange fake creatures in his world. So the goblins in Carter's game also melt into little puddles of goo, leaving behind only their caps, which are different colors, which are significant. It's awesome.
I'm convinced now that dungeon mastering is genetic, because Phil, Chatty DM, also says, like, he's tried to run his son in a couple adventures, and, you know, he's enjoyed it, and then, like, started to, he put a piece of paper from him and said, you know, you want to draw out the dungeon as you go, and he just, like, ran with it and started, like, sketching out dungeons wherever they went and populating with monsters and building, so
yeah.
I think
it's contagious.
Nature, nurture.
Yeah.
I remember driving my son to kindergarten one day, and he was sitting in the back of the car with the minis tiles that came with the miniatures game back in the day, and organizing them together into dungeons and writing out on a piece of paper what was in each room.
I think of it more like building Legos, because I'll sit there.
Which he also does a lot.
Yeah, which I did as a kid too. You know, like, just sit there with all the tiles and, like, lay them out and then put, like, little guys in them, and, you know, like, I'm on the floor, like, you know, like, kicking up in the air, you know, like. I probably shouldn't have admitted that on a recording, but anyway.
Yeah. When you were a kid, or like last weekend?
No, this was like last weekend.
Sure.
Like, I had an adventure to plan, so I was like, you know, looking through my dungeon tiles and my maps and stuff, and like, oh, these guys would totally be cool here, you know, like, kind of thing. Okay, so the alternate theory to dungeon mastering is genetic is that dungeon masters are just like kids.
Also possible.
All right, well, thank you very much.
Thank you. Appreciate
my pleasure.
It as always.
Thanks, guys.